can I have everyone's attention, please? We're just about to start. So firstly, I just want to say thank you everyone for turning up tonight. This is our first meeting as a new committee, having recently had our AGM. So welcome to the Sheffield Humanist Society. And if any of the committee members want to give everyone else a wave, please feel free to do so. Naomi, if you want to give people a wave. And we have Mike here and Colin and Phil. And a few others who couldn't be here tonight. Just want to briefly run through the format of the meeting before I do the introduction and introduce our speaker for tonight. We are going to have a presentation from our guest speaker, Hester Reeve, and then we're going to have a short break, and then there'll be a question and answer session if anybody would like to ask any questions about what has been said this evening. So as we've got some new people here tonight, I just wanted to let you know a little bit more about who we are and what we do. So as the name suggests, we are a collection of humanists and atheists who are working together to kind of look at some of the big issues that are affecting society today. Excuse me, I've made some notes. And also, I don't know if everyone here really knows what humanism is, because sometimes it's a bit of a grey area and explaining it is sometimes hard, but I'm going to give it a shot. Humanism is essentially a life stance that attributes importance to the here and now. So instead of focusing on a payday in the afterlife, we look at making positive changes while we're here on the earth to make society better, and that in itself is its own reward. That's my kind of spin on things. We have monthly meetings, which will be here on the first Tuesday of every month, and we'll be having a different guest speaker each month. Excuse me. And we'll be having Robin Grinter talk about David Hume and the Enlightenment next month. Then in January we're having our New Year social. In February we have Professor Jamal Khalili giving a talk, and that's actually going to be at the St George's Lecture Theatre in town. He's going to be speaking on humanism and our place in the universe. March, we have Ariane Shireen, who is the creator of the very successful Atheist Bus campaign back in 2009. She's also a comedian, a broadcaster, an author, and she's going to be giving a talk called How Can We Be Happy? It's a very positive one. You know, it's essentially how giving can lead to a happier life, essentially. And in April we have Tamina Kazi, who is the director of the British Muslims for Secular Democracy, and she's going to be discussing the issue of Sharia courts in the UK, so that could be quite an interesting talk. At the side of the room here we have some leaflets that tell people a little bit about humanism, secularism and so on. And it will also have some information about the British Humanist Association and the National Secular Society, to whom we are affiliated. And on your tables tonight, you should all have a flyer for the Uganda Humanist Schools Trust. This is a project in Uganda that provides secular education for children, regardless of their background and regardless of their beliefs. And we pay for a child to receive a scholarship every single year. We are on Facebook and Twitter as well, if anyone would like to join us. We have an email sign-up sheet if you want to receive updates from the Society. And you can also join the Society for £5, and that covers the entire year. The £5 will go towards just the general running of the Society, but it also contributes towards that scholarship for the Uganda Humanist Schools Trust. I'm not trying to bribe you at all, I promise, but it'll be £5 well spent, and it will essentially get you earlier tickets for the Professor Jamal Khalili event, and it may also provide discounts for sort of any catered events we do have, but more news of that will be to follow. Essentially, I think that's my bit done. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to hand over to our guest speaker. She is a lecturer of fine art at Sheffield Hallam University, and an artist whose live works have been shown nationally and internationally. She'll be examining the life and works of these suffragettes and questioning why their progressive ideas of art and politics are not given full merit today. So please give a warm welcome to Hester Reeve.
I'm not so good at belting out, so I'm going to put this on. Thank you.
Cheers. Just a minute.
Yes, that's it. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Is it okay?
Yeah. Yeah, I just don't want you to struggle hearing me, that's all. Thank you very much for inviting me. I'm doing this presentation is based on one I gave in summer for the Sylvia Pankhurst Memorial Lecture, which happens at Wortley Hall, where they have the Sylvia Pankhurst Library. And they usually invite people who talk specifically on historical and social aspects of Sylvia Pankhurst's work and life. And this year they invited me as an artist. That's because of some work I've done linked to the suffragettes. And that work led me to curate some artwork by Sylvia Pankhurst at Tate Britain, which happened 2013 to 2014. So I suppose I was quite an unusual speaker, and I'm probably not a very typical speaker about political causes, because I'm approaching this from the perspective of being a practicing artist, but nonetheless a practicing artist where issues of the relationship between art and how we might exist in the world, how we might change the world, difficult issues such as social progress. I've always been very interested in art's relationship to that, and I'm often aware that art has a non-relationship or might have a very obtuse relationship. I don't have any clear answers. I'm just very invested in a questioning between art and politics. So when I first started researching the suffragettes, it was an amazing discovery to me that many of the key militant suffragettes were also artists. And I should say that this research I've been carrying out, both in terms of sort of reading, but also in terms of making art, I've been making art as a way of rehistoricizing the suffragette legacy. I've been doing this with another artist called Olivia Plender, who's based in Sweden, so she's not here with me tonight, but it's a joint collaborative work, actually. I speak on behalf of both of us, and we work under an umbrella called the Emily Davison Lodge. And if there's time, I can talk about that later. Emily Davison, of course, was a sort of one of the few suffragettes whose name is remembered through history. She's a suffragette who unfortunately died under the King's Horse on the Epsom Racecourse. She wasn't martyring herself, she was trying to pin suffragette flags to the horse. And that, just that footnote there to Emily Davison, there's a lot of misunderstandings about the suffragette movement. And it's sort of handed down in a very strange and conservative format. Unless you study the suffragettes, it came across to me as a very typical person. I'd just heard of Emily Davison, I'd heard a little bit about Emmeline Pankhurst, that's Sylvia Pankhurst's mother, and there's a few references in films, like Mary Poppins. There's this crazy old lady who sings songs, sort of very sweet, but very hysterical, mumbling woman, as if the suffragettes were just a mad bunch of hysterical women. That's sort of how they get portrayed. So the research I've been doing has sort of shown me that, of course, that's not the case. And Sylvia Pankhurst becomes a particular case in point because she's not as well known as her mother, Emmeline Pankhurst, or her other sister, Christabel Pankhurst. And it should be said that all the Pankhursts were incredible political campaigners and that Sylvia Pankhurst, for my sort of opinion, is far more interesting and contemporarily relevant member of the Pankhurst troop. I find it interesting that she's maybe not as well remembered as Emmeline Pankhurst. So, and a little bit of that will come out as I talk. So, the militant suffragette is a militant artist. Not all suffragettes were militant, but the WSPU, the Women's Social and Political Union, this was a fiercely militant wing. They ripped up golf courses and graffitied them with slogans such as deeds, not words. They blew up postal depots. They threw hammers and rocks at the Prime Minister's car. They did things that are quite exceptional for that time, because at that time, women were not even allowed to speak out in public. One of the first protests that was part of the official suffragette WSPU campaign was actually Christabel Pankhurst and another suffragette who spoke out at a political meeting in Manchester. And all they did was stand up and shout out to some politicians, "What about votes for women?" That's all they did, and they were arrested for that. So it's not just the militancy, and I think the very creative aspect of their militancy that I'm interested in. It's the context. I think some of their work, for me, is very creative and radical by today's standards. But if we think of the early 1900s, then it becomes even more exceptional. And I suppose as an artist who's involved in live art, and by live art that means, I also draw and paint, but live art means when an artist uses their body as a medium for the work, which means less for me dance and theatre. I'm not interested in those modes. It means more a question of what can I do with my agency, what can I do with my body in the world. So there are parallels for me between the radical agency and the way suffragettes positioned their bodies in public positions, and how that set up a kind of debate, how that might have inspired people, and how that might have actually changed things. So I'm very interested in that. And today, this might not interest you or not, because I don't know how interested you are in art, but there's a growing interest in the relationship between art and politics. There's a growing interest in a relationship that can be made between things artists are interested in to what you might call non-artist areas in the world. So we could say a growing social awareness. But for the most part, I find this work, whilst really good-intentioned, sometimes ends up heroising the artist. So artists might work in the mental health care. I have no problem with that. I think it's a very interesting thing to do. But there are people who've worked in the mental health care creatively and dedicatedly for centuries who maybe don't appear in books and have glossy articles written about them. So I'm sort of have this troubled relationship to the way contemporary art plays itself out in the political sphere. I don't have answers, as I say, but when I look at the suffragettes, I suppose I find it's less a nostalgic look back. It's actually looking at them as potentially something that maybe can release something of importance about politics and art and politics and what individuals can do in a way that maybe we're ready or it's useful to hear now. So that's a little bit of context. Is this going to work? Oh, that's because I'm going the wrong way. I'm not actually going to talk about my artwork, but I did want to start with an image because, as I say, I'm working as an artist, and because this is an image of me with Olivier, and it's from a series of commissions we did for the Women's Library in London, which was where we first found out about Sylvia Pankhurst, not just being this exceptional political activist, but actually being an artist. So there was this incredible surprise and fascination in the fact that many of the militant suffragettes had also been artists. But then with that, a sort of sense of, well, why is this not so well known? Because to us that seemed actually quite interesting. Why is Sylvia Pankhurst well known in political spheres? But there's this sort of sense that the fact that she was also an artist is not relevant. That it's as if, when I've talked to Sylvia Pankhurst, people, scholars who are interested in her political career, which was exceptional, as I say, there's this sense of like, oh, she started out as an artist, and then she gave that up in order to be political. And actually, the fact that she gave her art practice up is something I'm going to read you a quote from her. I sort of have this sort of shock, horror, awe, respect for her for doing that. I'm not quite prepared to give my own practice up, but I suppose I practice as an artist continually in this sort of difficult position of wanting to give it up, not because I don't love art, but because of other things I'm interested in or trying to address, and I'm just not sure if it's a waste of time to do that through art, or if it's, you know, more about my pleasure than making something important happen. And I think art is always about making something important happen, whether it's a tiny little drawing or a sort of huge political rally. So we kind of, with our interest in particularly Silver Pankhurst, we're trying to challenge this notion that she did art, this was something pretty, beautiful, just for pleasure, and then she gave it up and then she did serious things. And we're trying to suggest that actually all she did was refocus her intelligence and her creative energy into some very exceptional political campaigning. And as you'll see, she never really stopped being an artist in a way. And the things she went on to make stand as very contemporary things in a way. This photo is taken in the archive of the Women's Library. So this is actually in the basement where normally you wouldn't go as a researcher. And you can see all these cardboard boxes. They're full of suffragette objects. Propaganda, certificates, medals. They would award medals to women that went on hunger strike in prison because many of the suffragettes were arrested and taken to prison, where they were treated quite badly and force-fed. And when they came out, they were given medals and certificates. And a lot of that stuff is very exciting to look at, and it's in these boxes. And we just wanted with this, we call it the re-inaugural meeting of the Emily Davison Lodge, which was formed by suffragettes after Emily Davison died, in order to answer the needs of the hour. And we felt that the feminist revolution was an ongoing revolution, that that it's almost like the demands of that revolution still need to be heard. It's ongoing. So we felt we had a right to kind of re-inaugurate the Emily Davison Lodge. And by that, put something that looks historical, Emily Davison, and this notion of a lodge, actually put it in a contemporary context. And we hope by the name that makes people think a little bit more about the suffragettes as something that maybe is relevant to today, rather than just a historical label. So here we are reading two female philosophers, two books by a female philosopher, Hannah Arendt, on violence, on revolution. We're also interested in the notion of violence. It's less because we want to set off bombs or anything like that. But there seems a way in which these female suffragettes were willing to go to places of militancy in the name of just causes that, to some degree, artists don't go today. And I know it's a very problematic and messy issue, but I kind of want to stick my fingers in that a little. And it's problematic because we've just made a photograph. This is just a performance. This isn't violent at all. But we wanted to suggest this notion of the artist studio as a potential underground cell. And during the suffragette campaign, some of these female suffragette artists, their studios became secret meeting places for suffragettes, particularly the Brackenbury sisters. And there was a famous window-smashing campaign in 1911 where all the streets on Oxford Street, the windows got smashed in by women who had the cobbles. They did it with cobbles, and they hid the cobbles in bags under their skirts. And the artist suffragettes had made these bags, and suffragettes would very secretly go and visit them at their studios if to have tea and cake, and come away with a bag hidden under their skirts with a cobblestone in. So this idea that a studio is a potential place for radical new thought and radical action was something we wanted to sort of suggest. Okay. Anyway, that's enough about our work. Sylvia Pankhurst. Here's one of the few photos of Sylvia Pankhurst in her studio. I think this is when she's at the Manchester School of Art, where she started studying in 1903, and she won an award. So this is at a time when not many women studied at art school. Women were just beginning to gain entry to art schools, and there weren't that many grants either. So I say this because she was good. This wasn't somebody who dabbled in art. This was somebody who was highly technically skilled, so much so that she gained a funded place at the Manchester School of Art. And I just say that to set off the sacrifice she made to give it up. And she says, I gave up my work as an artist. Excuse my typo. I gave up my work as an artist at 27 years of age when I was just becoming efficient from the technical point of view. We used this image at the beginning of the Sylvia Pankhurst display at Tate Britain, and I'll talk about that at the end. And we were slammed for doing that in Radical Philosophy. And I think it's a very interesting issue. They felt that by having Sylvia Pankhurst in her artist robes in the studio, we were just reaffirming a sort of grand narrative of the artist, solo artist genius in her studio. And I think that's a very interesting criticism in a way, but because Sylvia Pankhurst is never shown as an artist, I actually think this image is actually very important and not about that. Here's a study of a face, one of her early studies that she would have done at art school. It's technically proficient, it's not politically invested. It's just a portrait. I say that it's just a portrait. That's because, in contemporary art terms, we might enjoy making drawings and life drawings and portraits, but that's not something contemporary art necessarily is working with. But it shows her technical skills. And here's a more sort of explanatory quote of why she gave up this practice. And I should say that after she studied at Manchester College of Art, she won another award to go to the Royal College of Art, so she studied in London. She never finished her studies there because the political campaigning of the suffragettes had really taken off. And something else I should say as well is that the WSPU, the Women's Social and Political Union, started its life in 1903. And Emmeline Pankhurst starts that off. But Christabel and Sylvia are part of the beginning, even though they're quite young at the time. And one of the things that sparks that off is in Manchester, Sylvia's father, who's died and who was a notable sort of politician linked to the labour movement, a hall was built and dedicated to him. And Sylvia Pankhurst was asked to decorate, to adorn the building with banners and artworks, which she did. And when the Pankhurst Hall was open to the public, Sir Walter Crane, a very famous sort of arts and crafts-based artist who she was very influenced by and taught by, he was given the stage to open the building. And Sylvia Pankhurst, because she was a woman, she wasn't allowed to attend the opening of the building that she decorated. So again, just another little signpost of the times she was doing all this radical work in. Anyway, she says, whether it was worthwhile to fight one's individual struggle as fight one must, and that strenuously, to make one's way as an artist, to bring out of oneself the best possible, and to induce the world to accept one's creations and give one in return one's daily bread, when all the time the real struggles to better the world for humanity demand another service. So there's this sort of struggle that goes on in her of being this great artist, wanting to carry on with that, but through her work with the WSPU, fighting for the vote, but she's also very broadly concerned with poverty and working class issues and workers' rights. She was always ahead of her times. Out of all the sort of suffragette campaigners, Sylvia was the sort of intersectionist, the one who realised that if you were looking at the vote, you couldn't just take that alone, the female vote. You had to look more broadly at gender issues, at working conditions. And this is, very enlightened. So, and she realised that artwork wasn't necessarily going to help her do that. And this is from a letter that Olivia and I wrote to Tate Britain, because we were just quite shocked that even though today the art world is getting very interested in art and politics, that in the very good books that now exist around politically engaged art, they never once reference Sylvia Pankhurst's work. And in a way, she's our greatest legacy for that. So we wrote to the Tate suggesting that they start collecting and publicising her work. What is interesting is, even though she's having these difficult thoughts about the relationship between art and politics, she does this incredible thing called the Northern Workers' Tour. I think she's just 27, it's before she's officially given up art. This is actually one of my favourite works by her. It's a gouache. I think it's beautifully done. We could look at this and say, yes, this is a very good technical painting. It's a little bit classical, a little bit chocolate boxy, and it's a portrait of a woman. And then you realise, oh, this is a woman, this is a factory, this is actually in a cotton factory. And what she did was, of her own volition and as a young woman, she organised a tour of factories in the north of England where women were working, and she went and sat there with her paint set, because, of course, you know, it's hardly, you know, photography is expensive, isn't it? It's sort of infancy at this point. Painting the working conditions of women. And not only, so she's using art to make a historical document at a time when people weren't really noticing women's working conditions. There weren't that many campaigns around it. And she will famously later use the working conditions of women and their contribution to the British economy to help finally convince the Prime Minister that he should take the suffragettes and votes for women seriously. So for all the really amazing suffragette campaigning, and I think it was amazing, actually Asquith, the Prime Minister, only really started to budge when it came down to issues of working women's rights. And Sylvia Pankhurst was famous for pushing that later with her work with the East End, which I'll talk a little bit about in a minute. But already, at 27 years old, she's realising the importance of visualising these conditions. And she doesn't stop at that. She then writes about it in the Burlington magazine. So she's getting it out to a wider readership. Oh, sorry, I'm not very good with this stuff. Here's another quote. This is from the suffragette movement. She also wrote one of the most classic documentary books about the suffragette movement. It's a really big, large book. And this is a quote from there. It's mainly about the suffragette movement, but I sort of beachcombed it, and you can find these, as an artist, these quotes that move me greatly. And she says, "Always I was torn between the economic necessities of the immediate moment, the desire of further study to equip me for ambitious artworks, the urging of conscience to assist in the movement. Like many another young woman of my period, I was distraught by my solidarity with that rage of militancy. Even in the calm haven of the Royal College of Art, lulled by the manifest duty of work and study, to justify holding a scholarship, I asked Keir Hardie," who you're probably all aware of, famous Labour politician, "are we brothers of the brush?" I love that, brothers of the brush, great. "Are we brothers of the brush entitled to the luxury of release from utilitarian production? Is it just that we should be permitted to devote our entire lives to the creation of beauty while others are meshed in monotonous drudgery? Now facing alone the hard struggle of life as an unknown artist, nervous, diffident and in poor health, came the frequent question, why? As a speaker, a pamphlet seller, a chalker of pavements, a canvasser on doorsteps, you are wanted. As an artist, the world has no real use for you. In that capacity, you must fight a purely egotistical struggle." I'm always going to go the wrong way. And here, after she's given up her artwork, and anyone who's interested in her campaigning, I recommend a video that was only made a few years ago called "Everything is Possible" by Worldwright. It's an absolutely amazing showcase, mainly of her political work, because I really don't want to downplay that. It's just that no one's talked about the relationship of her art practice to that work, so I'm focusing mainly on that. And here we have images from her famous banners. She got other people from the Royal College of Art. They're sort of very heavily influenced by the arts and craft movement. And she designed these, and then they were hand-painted, because, of course, this is not the age where you can send things in a digital file and have them done overnight. So you can just see in this top slide to the right these banners going all the way down this large exhibition, which, if I remember rightly, is 1911, I think it is. And at the height of the militant suffragette campaign, they held a sort of huge fair where they sold suffragette memorabilia, jams. There was always this sort of strange tension between utter violence on one hand and then cakes and tea parties and needlecraft. And I really love this relationship between domestic creativity, which I've always been a big fan of, and then sort of the willingness to put their bodies on the street and getting sometimes bloodbaths with the police. So that's that. Sylvia Pankhurst designed much of the campaign imagery for the suffragettes, and it's claimed that the suffragette movement was one of the first to successfully use sort of visual imagery successfully to sort of draw the public in. And something I hadn't realised was I thought the suffragettes were kind of a small band of quite posh women that sort of used their money and their position to try and lobby Parliament. And I was sort of in awe of them for doing that. But actually, it was a mass movement. The suffragettes, they were like, you know, when they did their big marches in London, there would be, you know, thousands and thousands of suffragettes and suffragette supporters from around the country. It was that much of a popular movement that sweet shops would sell suffragette memorabilia, a bit like when we have a royal wedding, we have sort of napkins and china cups. So the success of the movement is, of course, because they're fighting for the female vote, but also because of this incredibly rich visual iconography that they use, and also their amazing pageants and spectacles. This is also designed by Sylvia Pankhurst. This is my favourite aspect of her visual propaganda. It's actually really, really tiny. It's about this big, and it's called the Holloway Brooch, and she's modelled it on the prison portcullis. And then here we have a prison arrow, and the three suffragette colours of green, white, and violet. And this was what was awarded to every woman that came out after she'd endured a hunger strike and forced feeding by the British government. And I don't know how much people know about that, but you can ask me questions if you want to know more about that afterwards. And I love this. She says, the creation of a Michelangelo would have ranked low in the eyes of the WSPU members besides a term served in Holloway. And I thought I had a slide earlier on, and let me just check. Haven't jumped slides here. There's something that gets quoted about how, at the time, about how women should not be considered as great artists because no woman has created a Michelangelo, for example. And I think Sylvia Pankhurst is very aware of that patriarchal criticism of women not being able to be artists. And I love the way she turns that around and says, well, actually, for the suffragette campaign, creating a painting is not the kind of artwork we're looking at. And one of the things that Olivia and I are interested in, this notion of the militant suffragette as a militant artist, is this notion that there's a sort of radical artwork dimension to the things they're doing that we find very inspiring to us today. Here's another of her drawing from the Northern Workers' Tour. This is a charcoal one of women working in the ceramics industry from Staffordshire. And I've just shown this because we used this in an exhibition at the Women's Library with a letter that was written to the Tate. And it's just a very small gesture. But when we make our work, our artworks that are trying to call some attention or to allow the impact of some of the creative aspects of the suffragettes to sort of reach us now and have some effect on us as either political people, as creative people. We try to make every artwork less be visually powerful, but more have a sense of doing something in the world. Because we thought we can't access all this suffragette literature and memorabilia and artwork and keep it caught up in an artwork. It's almost like we have to use it so it can do something. So this is why we wrote the letter to the Tate. The letter's quite long, it's 4 pages long, where we basically contextualise the importance of Sylvia Pankhurst. But we used it as a way to inform people in the exhibition so that when they see her work, you can't just take this as an innocuous representational portrait of a woman. Suddenly you realise this is actually like a little... This is politically radioactive, this image. This image now can do something, or certainly did something in its own time. But we actually sent the letter out to see if it could have an impact, which in the end, luckily, it did. She also wrote articles about life in prison. She served prison sentences like the other women, and did illustrations. So again, the visual material, they were masters of visual material. Here's one of the few photos showing Sylvia Pankhurst in her actual, you know, street campaigns and being arrested. She herself was very anti-violence, and in the end, she split from her mother and Christabel, from the WSPU, because she disagreed with the violence. I should say that with the suffragettes and the violence, there was a rule that you never harmed a human life, and there were no lives ever damaged, other than Emily Davison, and that was an accident, that was a mistake, and that was her own life. And then this other aspect of sort of looking at the militant suffragette as a kind of radical militant artist is that one of the other things that the suffragettes did that I'd never heard about until I did the research at the Women's Library was they went on a systematic campaign of destroying artworks. And of course, at first for me, I found that astonishingly disturbing. But what they were really doing was realising the way that artworks can become a sort of fetish of private property. So on one hand, they're very beautiful things, and they're skilled things, and they're things that can bring value to life, for sure. But actually, who owns these famous paintings? You know, it's sort of large-scale organisations funded often by big business. That actually, this is from the Venus, the Rockaby Venus by Velasquez, that had just been purchased by the British government. I think this was slashed in 19... I can't remember the date, you have to get it. It's 1913, I think. And so a suffragette was actually slashed by someone called Mary Richardson. She was herself a practising artist. So she valued art, but she slashed this with a butcher's cleaver. So I love this idea of this woman going into the art gallery and... Hi, she hid the butcher's cleaver up her sleeve on the end of a chain she'd made out of safety pins. She brought her sketchbook as a decoy, and she spent ages drawing from the Rockaby Venus, so in the end the guards just sort of, she became invisible and walked out, and as soon as the guards left, out came the meat cleaver. And she chose this image, one, because it had seemed this sort of emblem of sort of the status of private property. And she made this very powerful statement saying the British government would rather protect a painting of a woman than look after real women and their vote. And at this time, Emmeline Pankhurst, leading the suffragette movement, was actually in prison for about her 7th successive hunger strike. And she was being kept in a very damp cell with no heat. And she was on a hunger strike. And there were fears. I mean, she was near death. And the British government were holding her in prison and not treating her as a political prisoner. So there was this sense, and Mary Richardson makes this clear in a statement to the press, so very carefully calculated, very creative action, that the government should honour the real living body of Emmeline Pankhurst, who was a far more beautiful female body than this idolised sort of naked woman, which has really been painted possibly for a male patron, for the male eyes. So this is a very complicated, very creative, and very intellectual campaign. And it wasn't, this wasn't a one-off. There were many, many paintings damaged across the country. And this is Mary Richardson leaving court. And this is a pen and ink, hand pen and ink version of that. We made some chapbooks wherever we could find photographs that touched on the real women, because we became very interested in who were these real women. There were also artists that have somehow been totally forgotten in history. And I have to say it's very, very hard to find anything about their lives. What's great is things keep coming out of the woodwork. There's one suffragette, Bertha Graham, who slashed some artwork. She wasn't an artist, to the best of my knowledge. And I just met one of her great-great-granddaughters through doing the talk at Wortley Hall, who has an attic full of all the suffragette stuff. So this stuff is laying in people's attics. So hopefully it's protected, or soon we can find out about it. But anyway, because you have to pay copyright, we ended up using our artistic skills to reproduce them so that then we could reproduce them without paying copyright. And as an artist, I haven't really done much illustration because my work's become quite sort of contemporary and conceptual. And I found it a joy to just, in a way, be useful. So painting a lot of these photos, and of course when you paint from the photos, you find out stuff, which is interesting. So anyway, this is the real lady. This is Mary Richardson herself. Here's her statement. I have tried to destroy the picture of the most beautiful woman in mythological history as a protest against the government for destroying Mrs. Pankhurst, who is the most beautiful character in modern history. I'm really sorry, I'm so back to front, I'm a bit dyspraxic. So as part of our work at the Women's Library, we also did a lot of research and put it together as much as possible about who these different women were, one of whom was also Sylvia Pankhurst, one of the first. She threw a rock, she didn't damage it, she threw a rock in St. Stephen's Hall in the Parliament buildings. Here's another page of the research. And this research is ongoing. And in terms of the Sylvia Pankhurst display at Tate Britain, we only showed her artwork because we wanted to make people, well, we were happy for anyone in the British public to experience her work and remember about suffragettes. And we got really positive feedback from people who hadn't realised anything about the creative output for suffragettes or had never heard of Sylvia Pankhurst before. So we were sort of thought, job done, if more people in the country understood and were inspired by, I mean, I think that's what we want to do, we want to inspire people by this sort of radical history. But we also wanted to sort of raise awareness in the art world of Sylvia Pankhurst so that she might get more mentioned in discussions around the relationship between art and politics, but also that we might complicate that relationship because we think it's quite a complicated one and that's actually quite exciting. That might actually be an impetus for art to take a few more risks, or possibly for some artists to give up art and realise a radical form of body-based protest art, potentially. There's no right answer. But because we were aware we might have an art audience coming who wouldn't know about her political work, we were asked as artists to contribute to the show because the Tate were very interested in the fact that it was artists who wanted to make a platform for Sylvia Pankhurst, the artist. We did a series of drawings, very tiny drawings, and in this case, I didn't draw from a photograph. What I did was I took some of the most inspiring aspects of Sylvia Pankhurst's political campaigning that there are no photos of, because this isn't the age where everyone pulls out a mobile. And this is a picture of her, this is my imagined picture of her in St. Stephen's Hall in the Houses of Parliament, throwing a stone at the removal of the Speaker. That painting does belong in the Houses of Parliament, but it doesn't actually belong in St. Stephen's Hall. I've sort of changed it around so that there is this sense of as if it could have been done from a photo, because of course it's actual that she did that. So there was a sense of enabling people to know that she was also this political activist, but that also suggesting that maybe that's even far more radically artistic than some of her artworks. What was also interesting to me was that I then found quite a lot of illustrations, much more technically proficient. This is from the window smashing campaign. So often artists were employed to just illustrate some of the suffragette activities at the time, because there wouldn't have been a cameraman, or it would have been too expensive to have done that. This is based on an MOD document. These are two artists who destroyed slashed works in the Manchester Museum of Art. It was across the country. And here they are. I don't know, I just find it so... I don't know what it is, I just get very excited. It's just very simple. I get very excited when I see them as real people. I risk over-romanticising it, and I really don't want to do that. But I've also become very, very interested in the private lives of these women. Some of them had friendships that changed their lives. The way society was organised, women might not have been able to get up to the kind of shenanigans that they got up to at the suffragette meetings. So I'm also interested in the way the suffragette movement changed people's lives. And we can't see that stuff. And today, all our political and artistic movements happen so much in the public eye. Everything's public, everything's explained, everything's participatory. And I know that's not a bad thing, but I sometimes wonder, sometimes the things that happen behind closed doors and in private might be more revolutionary. And I don't know if it's me, but there's a glint in their eye. I really get off on it. Here's a portrait of Thomas Carlyle by John Everett Millais that got damaged. I mean, this stuff is really effective as well. The British Museum Service were so worried that there was a meeting held in London at the time where they decided they would ban women from entering major art institutions in the country. So their strategies were sort of working, even though that response is shocking. The only reason the British sort of cultural industries decided that they wouldn't ban women was because they were worried it would damage the economy through tourism. So signs went up in museums and at galleries, particularly in London, that said women only allowed if accompanied by a man who can vouch for their good behaviour, and no muffs. Because of course you can hide truncheons and meat cleavers in your muff. Again, this sort of thing, this pretty sort of feminine sort of muff thing, and then a cleaver in the middle of it. I like it. This is just a small, I won't read the whole thing out, but it's interesting, as I say, that many artists joined the suffragette movement. And I suppose if you were a woman and you were an artist at that time, when critics were saying women can't be artists, they can't create, and Michelangelo, then you would want more political power, and you would already be maybe quite an autonomous, outspoken person to have stood up and decided, no, I'm going to make my way in the world as an artist. It's not that easy to do that today as a man or a woman. It would have been quite a challenge as a woman in those times. And this is Marion Dunlop, also an artist. She did this great thing. The suffragettes are often petitioning and demonstrating and being told they weren't allowed to do it. And so, whereas actually, by law, they were allowed to. So she makes this rubber stamp. And it's a really weird object, handmade, and it says, Women's Deputation, June 29th, Bill of Rights. It is the right of the subjects to petition the king, and all commitments and all the prosecutions for such petitionings are illegal. A bold statement, and she makes a stamp. She gets violet ink, suffragette colour, and goes into St. Stephen's Hall, I guess as a tourist. I don't know where she kept it, up her skirt, potentially. And then she just stamps it on the wall in there. Here we have something from the coronation procession 1911, all the costumes created in the Brackenbury studios. And the suffragettes were really good at taking sort of ritualistic and cultish visual images and then almost normalising them and making them popular. The images of their pageants, I think, are breathtaking. The funeral, I don't know if anyone's seen the photos of Emily Davison's funeral. Those images are, I mean, breathtaking. Half because they're old photos, there's a little bit of that that comes into it, but they, the banners and the procession, very powerful stuff. And here we have banner making. The other thing that the suffragettes did a lot of was chalk drawing. One of the quick ways to advertise meetings was to do it on the day and just to chalk it directly on the floor. It's cheap, it's efficient, and also if you were to spend money on posters and your posters go up, people can always rip the poster off. So this was also a sort of form of protection, like a kind of, what do they call it, mobbing? Flash mobbing? Kind of like a suffragette flash mobbing. This is Georgette Brackenbury, one of the key artists in the suffragette movement, and she's here modelling herself as a suffragette in prison. They used this to illustrate things written by Sylvia Pankhurst about the conditions in the prison. Because then if the suffragettes hadn't written about that and made these images, no one would have known. Here's a banner from the Artists' League. Some artists formed together to form the League, and then they helped with all the processions and banner making. And this is in the London Museum, or the Museum of London. It's a particularly beautiful banner. There was also something called the Suffragette Atelier, set up by two artists, a brother and sister, Lynn and Ralph, I think, I can't remember, Lynn Herman and Ralph Herman. And the Suffragette Atelier had this incredible sort of non-elitist sort of foundation. So it wasn't for professional artists, it was for any woman who wanted to learn how to make posters, banners, or propaganda. And it was just a big studio, and you came in, you had to wear a really thick blue apron, and they're beautiful. And then you were given materials and shown how to woodcut, anything direct and quick to get the message out. So there's something very empowering to women about that. And this is members of the Suffragette Atelier with, they've used the artist palette as a sort of banner, and they're about to go on a demonstration, suffragette demonstration. And then I wanted to include this, although this talk is mainly focused on Sylvia Pankhurst and mentioning a few other key artists, Emily Davison, she would have considered herself a writer, but she was also a painter. And sadly, her husband thought she was a bad painter and burnt all her paintings. So we don't have any of them left, which is such a shame. But one of the things, I'm more interested in the suffragettes who were artists in terms of the actions they did. So I'm interested in the Brackenburys getting women to lift up their skirts and tie cobblestones underneath. I'm interested in the fact that Emily Davison did these radical acts with her body. And this one is less known. Everyone knows about the Derby. This, she smuggled herself in to Houses of Parliament. You could go on tourist tours, but there are parts of the Houses of Parliament that are obviously out of bounds. And she managed to get to the chapel, I think it's called St. Mary's Chapel or St. Anne's Chapel, forgive me, and there's a chapel underground. And she hid in the broom cupboard. Now, she hid in the broom cupboard on a certain day, deliberately, because a few months later the national census was drawn and everybody had to declare where they lived. And she wanted to be able to say in all honesty when she was asked, where were you living on April the 11th, that she lived in the House of Commons. So there's this sort of claim of her right as a woman to sort of exist at the core of where political decisions are made. I just think that's an exceptional, radical act. And Tony Benn honoured that by putting a plaque on the door of the broom cupboard. And you can't, it's out of bounds, you can't go there. But apparently a lot of politicians like to take visitors down and they sort of lock them in the cupboard because you have to be locked in the broom cupboard, and it is still a sort of storage cupboard, to see the plaque. And I think that's, for me, as good as the suffragette Sistine Chapel ceiling. And I'm almost at the end of the talk now. So, yes, we had her work at the Tate. Wonderful that they responded to the letter and showed her work. Shame they haven't brought the work. Shame the collection can't be permanent. But it was a good step. We can link this to issues around feminism and feminist curation, which I'm becoming very interested in. I'm certainly no expert in. And this sense that whilst as a, you know, I'm very lucky to be a female artist in this era, haven't got the struggles of artists in Sylvia's time. But nonetheless, the proportion of the representation of women artists in the larger galleries, it's still kind of low. Prices, male artists achieve higher prices. So again, these sort of the social issues around this are still ongoing. Female art students just beginning to be interested and not scared of talking about feminism, starting to feel excited about it, which is really good. But for many years as an art teacher, I found it very hard to engage younger female artists in the issue of feminism, as if it's something that's uncool and not exciting, when it's not just necessary, but it's hugely exciting and creatively provocative. And then a few shots from the show. Here is the artwork that I made with Olivia with the drawings. We called it the working table of the Emily Davison Lodge. Here's one of Sylvia Pankhurst's banner designs. This is where the little pendant, the Holloway pendant, is. We showed many of her, most part of it was her images of the Northern Workers' Tour. And they'd never been shown as a collection, and it's not the whole collection, but a good proportion of them. And I think it speaks for her technical skill, as well as an interesting visual arts campaign about working conditions. Nonetheless, although she did give up her career as an artist, I think the sacrifice of that is all the more extraordinary, because her son, Richard Pankhurst, told me that wherever she went, she carried her tin of watercolour paints, and she knew she'd never use them. And she eventually moved to Ethiopia, where she was working with sort of Pan-African movement. Her political work was, as I say, quite extraordinary. But she always carried her paints with her. And here she says, the idea of giving up the artist's life, surrendering the study of colour and form, laying aside the beloved pigments and brushes, to wear out one's life on the platform and the chair at the street corner, was a prospect too tragically grey and barren to endure. So she throughout her life, talked about that sort of the difficulty and how much she missed her work. And then here, just what I find interesting is when she left the WSPU, because when war broke out in 1914, the militant suffragettes, I think quite surprisingly, literally said, okay, campaign over. Having done the most incredible campaigning and being really persistent, suddenly they just sort of gave it all up to help the war cause. Sylvia Pankhurst was the one sort of suffragette that didn't do that. And she split from them and formed the East London Suffragette Federation. And while she was there working with the suffrage issue, she also set up, for example, a toy factory which employed 59 women and made really beautiful toys. So, you know, there's still this sense of allowing beauty, which is something we can link to art, to sort of infiltrate and have its place. And I think I'll finish there, I think, if that's okay.
Thank you. So if we could all thank Hester for... Okay, so what we'll do now is we'll have a short break so everyone can stretch their legs and get themselves a drink. But over the break, what we're going to be doing is selling some raffle tickets to win one of a couple of bottles of nice wine we have, because we're actually fundraising to help a campaign to have a statue of Sylvia Pankhurst built in London. Obviously, due to the work she did, there is a statue of Emmeline Pankhurst, but as you heard, Sylvia Pankhurst does get quite left out. So we've got funding tickets, but we're also doing a collection bucket if you want to chip in as well. All contributions are welcome. So if we could, say, take 15 minutes and be back by 9:15, and we'll have a question and answer session after that. So thank you very much. First winner is number 38.
38?
38.
That's me.
Come and pick a prize.
Must be exactly what we are.
I'm in
shock. Glad you were sitting down, eh?
That's a double take on that one.
There you go. Pick which one.
Say.
Which one you want?
You just want that one to set. Is that what you want?
36 to, yeah, that's fine. Just hang on to that, eh?
Yeah. It's just a sparkling white wine.
Is that red wine?
That's a red.
Yeah. That'll do for me.
Okay.
Thank you.
And the next winner is somebody that actually isn't here. I've got her phone number. I'll be calling her shortly. So that's the very brief raffle.
It's you, isn't it?
Sadly, it's not. No, didn't have enough change. Okay, so we're now going to have a question and answer session with Hester. What I'll do is, if more than one person has a question at a time, I will just kind of nod or point at you, make a note, and then we'll come back to you so we can try and cover everybody. So if you're happy to...
Yeah, I'm happy for it to be a discussion or Q&A. It doesn't have to be too official. Not like a font of facts, but...
Oh, no, essentially it's just so I can see people. Okay, does anybody have a question to start with? Okay, gentlemen there.
Before we start, we have a question. We have a question as well. First of all, thanks for the talk. I think it's great that Sylvia Pankhurst spoke, but Pankhurst and also forget she has been ignored. I think she'll be hard to show the work she does as a suffragette as well. I think she's really good and needs to put back into mainstream. But on the other hand, I've got to understand why she has been ignored. You were able to talk about militancy and you made a point about there have been anti-violence. I think that's an interesting point to make, because actually Sylvia Pankhurst wasn't anti-violent. She was opposed to violence during the suffragette period on a tactical basis. And of all the suffragettes, comparison to her sister and her mother, she was actually less violent. And I think that leads to another question, because Sylvia Pankhurst opposed the sort of inter-imperialist war, the First World War, as we call it now, on the basis of her commitment to socialist communist politics, whereas a sister and a mother didn't. They were quite happy to subscribe to, you know, Nation First, and were quite happy to hand out the white feathers. So I think she's ignored because some of the suffragettes can be accommodated into mainstream narratives today, because after all, we all support women's suffrage to a certain extent. So they can be celebrated, but Sylvia doesn't fit into that.
Yes.
You know, Sylvia went on to become, and she always was a socialist, a communist. Yes. She supported the East Uprising, she welcomed the Bolshevik Revolution, she set up her own communist movement. That doesn't fit comfortably with the other suffragettes, so she's ignored because of that. But then on the other side, in terms of a commitment to left-wing politics, she's looking ignored as well. She's not easy to categorise. She fell out with Lenin and the Bolsheviks, for example. She had views about, she had very different views and ideas about what we knew about workers' councils and Soviets. She tried to broaden it so that it included women and children, so that the Soviet would be seen as a social thing rather than just a workplace orientated thing. And then later on, during the 20s and 30s, you know, again, she's difficult to categorise. She identified with, for example, Haile Selassie and the Ethiopian, for want of a better word, you know, feudal theocracy, under the guise of anti-fascism. Now that government wasn't any friend of working class people and speaking of women's rights, but that's where she ended up. And that's where
she's on it. She's got a state.
She's got a state there. So again, you know, so you've got the suffragettes on the one side, you've got conventional net histories on that side, you've got the wife's history, and she doesn't fit comfortably into that. So, I mean, not for any fault of her own, she made huge contributions to all these fields. But she's not easy to categorise, and she's not easy to use as some sort of, you know, she was one of us.
Yes.
She doesn't fit into any of that. That's a statement. The question is that you stopped with her contribution to suffragette art and to the work there, and yeah, you made the statement that she did give up art. But could you tell me anything more? Because I don't honestly know, because like you say, it's very much like, up to the end of the First World War, Sylvia Pankhurst's artist as suffragettes, the way it becomes more political with what you put in. What sort of artistic cultural contributions did you make at the end of that period and afterwards? You know, because if you look at Workers' Dreadnought, which was her paper, it was one of the first to popularise and to actually publish the work of anti-war poets.
Yes. Yes. And
no one touches upon that. So that England,
no, I think all of that's really... Well, I think all of that stuff's very, very relevant, and she also wrote a few poems, but I'm really not a Sylvia Pankhurst scholar. I mean, I think you can answer that question better than me. I mean, I read about her because I'm very, very interested in her, but all I know is that she, you know, that sort of visual propaganda stops really with the East End, you know, Workers' Federation. There's some sort of work on the, you know, the Workers' Dreadnought and that newspaper, and then there's another magazine that she founds, and she writes, and I don't know if you know, the next thing I want to look at is some interest in her sort of her creative output, is that she kept journal notes throughout her life, and particularly her views around sort of socialism, communism, and it's called The Red Dawn or something like that, and it's never been published, and it exists in fragments in there's an archive of social history in Holland, which I've never been to. But I know the organisation that made this video about her political work, which talks more about all of these things, which is brilliant, by the way. And I only really know what I know about those things through that, and a little bit of reading. Then that organisation that made the video, they've got photocopies of all that stuff, because they went out and photocopied it, so I'm going to go and study it now, but I haven't read all of that. And then she worked for the anti-air bombing. She has a monument that's just been sort of they've just done a re-inauguration of her monument. It's just been, what's the word when it's...
Rededicated,
thank you very much. Because it's also been, it was falling into disrepair, and it's been sort of smartened up, shall we say, in Woodford and Essex. She lived for a while in Woodford and Essex after her more suffragette-related activities, before she moved to Ethiopia. And while she was there, she campaigned and got money for an anti-bombing from the air monument. And that's been erected there. I haven't actually seen it, unfortunately. So I think all of that stuff has a very creative visual bent to it as well. But apart from that, and then working with the Workers' Dreadnought, it seems to me, but you probably know better than me, that she was very, very much dedicated to sort of more... sort of campaigning and anti-fascist work with her husband, or she didn't marry, but with her partner, and then working that way. So I, for me, my knowledge of her sort of visual propaganda does sort of seem to end around the time of the suffragette movement, as far as I know, but I'm not best placed to answer.
Okay, the next question is from the chat.
I think one of your slides, you said, was a document from the MOD, you said? I'm not sure if it was called the MOD, but anyway, I was wondering, have you come across any evidence of kind of police or intelligence services infiltration and kind of dirty tricks at the time?
No, not...
Because, as I said, to kind of put it into context, we know now that over the last couple of decades, kind of police in the UK have been going as far as having relationships with women, having babies with women while undercover in order to kind of infiltrate movements. And I was just wondering do we know if they were up to that kind of stuff then?
Well, I don't know that. I mean, I know that there's some pretty horrible stuff, like the image of Evelyn Mansetta. As far as I know, it's from the Ministry of Defence, that's the reference to it, but whatever that organisation was then. In it, she sort of
was a bit like this, but it's just a picture of her. And there's a very interesting website where they reveal that the original photo had a policeman who's got his arm round her from the back. This isn't quite the same, but it shows sort of the sort of infiltration of police. And he's forcing her, she didn't want her photo taken. And so he forces her still so that he can keep her head up so she can get that prison sort of offender profile. And in the actual original photo, you can't see it so well in my illustration, she's trying to distort her face with her mouth. So they did things like that, and the police were very ruthless, but it, from the reading I've done, I've not heard of anyone actually infiltrating. You also have the anti-suffragettes. You have women and men who were campaigning against female suffrage. You have that sort of shenanigans going on, slightly perverse and horrible, and some really nasty postcards and sort of piss takes of the suffragette movement. But that's all still above board compared to what's been going on recently, and as far as I know, no. But again, I'm sort of an artist who's researching certain artists' suffragettes, and with that comes a reading. Like, I know a hell of a lot more about the suffragette campaigns than I used to, and I find it very, very interesting, but I'm not that sort of scholar. So, but no, I've not come against
what kind of comparisons would you draw, if you don't draw any, between the suffragette movement and things like Pussy Riot in Moscow and Marion Nemars and the company who've got the kit off recently? Is that, would you draw any comparisons with suffragettes with that?
No.
Not the same thing.
Well, I think we can very easily draw comparisons, and I think sometimes that doesn't actually add anything. So yes, I mean, definitely, I've been thinking a lot about Pussy Riot, I'm very interested in artist protest or protest that's not by artists, but you look at and as much as it's doing its political job, I feel stimulated visually. And in the way that an artwork might stimulate me, and I'm quite interested in that. The difference, the reason why I'm hesitant to say, oh yes, there's a comparison, is one, because I don't ultimately know what my position is on this relationship between art and politics. Two, because what fascinates me with some of the suffragette work was the way it was so systematic, and that it wasn't a one-off. I mean, it was very brave what Pussy Riot did, and I totally agree with the sort of repressive situation they were fighting, demonstrating against. And it's something quite interesting that is knitted. I get off on that. But also, there's something far more attention-seeking about that than some of the suffragette activities. And so I think there are differences there, and I think the suffragettes weren't intended in any way to be culturally important. Mainly because of their times, maybe. Whereas I think Pussy Riot were very aware of the cultural importance of what they were doing, because we live in far more... artists today are far more aware of the histories and the discourses, and that something they do might be culturally relevant. And that's not to judge it in any way, but it makes it slightly different, I think. What do you think?
Well, I don't know. I was just... I was aware of what was going on, you know, recently, but I don't know much about suffragettes, except, like you say,
yeah.
Mary Poppins,
yeah.
Things like that.
Yeah.
I've not come across much about it other than that.
I'm very interested in the actual women in Pussy Riot. I think they're really bright and really... So I'm very taken by... particularly those three women. And maybe there's more of a comparison there between them as individuals than the actual sort of action. But yeah, I'm interested for sure.
Did the suffragettes marching and protests actually make any difference to the parliament deciding particular women with votes, because as I understand it, this was coming anyway. There were...
What was coming? Votes for women?
Votes for women was coming anyway. There was a wide agreement amongst parliamentarians that it should happen. And of course the men got it. It was given universal suffrage for men, but it came about the same time. So
it wasn't the same time. It was in the, well, I don't know the actual date, but male suffrage was...
Well, it was...
You mean universal suffrage?
After the 1948 war, after the First World War.
Yes.
It was...
No, but that...
So the men got universal suffrage after 1918.
Oh, I
women
got, I thought men had already got universal suffrage.
No,
by
no, they hadn't.
Okay, that's
and women got it, those over 30, sometime 1927, something like that. I'm just wondering if all the protests actually made any difference at all, especially the violence. This was, as I understand it, the press who initially supported them. The violence caused the press to turn against them. feeling it was not as effective as people imagined. It's very dramatic, possibly artistic, but...
Well, from my understanding, I'd say you were right, that the processions and all those marches weren't the things that convinced the government.
No.
I know that there were certain politicians, especially at the beginning of the militant campaign, who were confident that the Bill of Rights would go through. From my reading, it seems every time it went through government, there was always quite powerful people in the Prime Minister who would just stop it. And the only, this is a sort of layperson's reading, of course, I'm not a historian, but the only time that there was some sort of muttering of like, oh, actually this time we will peg an amendment on that gives rights to women as well. That's right, universal suffrage, now I'm really, yes, universal suffrage, and would peg on this amendment to give women the vote. The only time the government sort of said, oh, actually it's looking possible, was just before the King's coronation, because what they didn't want was protests or any action on the street. And as a result of them saying, yes, it's looking like it's going to happen, the suffragette activity died down. And then, of course, as soon as the King's coronation was over, for about the fifth time in one of these procedures through Parliament, yet again, they didn't make the amendment for the female vote. And it was at that point that the violence really stepped up, because by that point, the suffragette campaign was like, you know, we've been basically pushed around and promised this and not given it, promised this, not given this. And they'd already been beat. I mean, Black Friday had already happened. And I know it got very violent, but it was the police who forced the violence. I mean, Churchill himself is famous for pushing Sylvia Pankhurst into the corner of a stage. So, I mean, a different event, that wasn't Black Friday, but, you know, and that wasn't reported at the time, and most people don't know that about, maybe should be surprised, but people don't know that about Winston Churchill. The police brutality at Black Friday, quite a large amount of suffragettes who'd met at Caxton Hall decided to storm the Houses of Parliament because they'd yet again refused to put an amendment on the Universal Bill of Rights, and they were hoping that it would pass through. So they just they had a petition, they were carrying their certificates. They went to demand audience, and of course didn't get it, and the police came in and, you know, cornered them, and then this awful violence took place. But, I mean, that was caused by police tactics.
Yeah.
Women, suffragette women never went out to hit people, you know.
No, I understand that, yeah.
So actually, back to your question, I mean, personally, I don't have a sort of problem with that, because I...
Problem with what, sorry?
With the fact that the processions weren't the thing that got the vote, because I still see them as a hugely, at least it got the issue talked about in the country.
We're still talking about it now.
Yes, and it's about
because
forming a movement and exciting people.
Yeah.
I mean, I actually think that processions and protests are about changing policy. So, first and foremost, I totally understand where you're coming from. That's why we do it. We don't just do it because we want to get good photos or make a movement. But nowadays, it seems that we understand, often with a protest, or that there are all these other things, that functions that it's fulfilling, that are really valuable. So I think it did a lot of really incredible, valuable things. But it's not what got women vote. And that's why I said at the beginning that actually one of the time when Asquith, for the first time, really sort of the penny dropped and he started to concretely talk about the fact that this was necessary and on the cards, was after Sylvia Pankhurst in her East London Workers' Federation sent a deputation of working women. And she'd already published drawings and there'd been articles, and then she was working with women's suffrage but also workers' rights, and she sent the women, a private audience, about 7 women, and she didn't go with them, which I think is really fantastic. She let them represent themselves, and she was always interested, which I think is very enlightened, to empower the working women to stand up and speak up for themselves. So they went, and it was at that hearing, also the war had broken out and women were also working for the war, you know, campaign. Their work was more visible, shall we say. And that had far more impact, Sylvia Pankhurst's work, than the processions. But I still find the processions amazing.
can I just interject something there very briefly as a comment? I'm not a historian. I have no idea whether that's a good interpretation of what happened, whether it was going to happen anyway. But if it was going to happen anyway, without the protests, it would be one of the few occasions when something of that kind was achieved without the struggle.
Mm-hmm.
Because there haven't been many occasions when anybody in power has said, we think it would be a good idea to do this, and given away against what would have been opposition, but there's plenty of opposition to say, on the whole, we think this would be the right thing to do, without ever coming under any kind of pressure. I find it a bit hard to believe that.
No, well, I find it hard to believe too. I have been told this.
Yeah.
I don't know its veracity.
Yeah.
And I wanted to see what other people thought.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I don't. Politicians are. We generally expect there to be. Has to be significant pressure before anything happens.
Yes.
To run.
Yes. Yeah,
maybe we are to some degree wrong about this, but I don't know.
One thing that I think is important about the processions and any protest is, because I'm not sure, well, this is just me, but I've got complicated sort of ideas and things. I'm not sure if protest is what changes things. So, you know, and I'm not saying protest shouldn't happen, but I am particularly in today, well, we know that in today's world. So, but that doesn't mean it shouldn't happen, of course. So, but I am really interested in how things change. But I think, particularly at that time, it would have been very easy, and certain men did sort of poo-poo the suffragette movement. You were reminding me in the break how the word suffragette first came from the Daily Mail, when they used it as a patronising word, because you had the male suffrage fighters, and they were like, oh, these suffragettes, these silly women. And then the name just stuck, and didn't take on such negative connotations. But I think the fact that so many women marched at a time when, as I say, women were arrested for speaking out in public at a public meeting, that thousands, they came from all over the country and all classes, that they, you know, the famous mud march, you know, I mean, I'm not very good at remembering one. I think it's something like 60,000. I mean, it's, you know, this is 1911, for God's sakes, you know, and women came from all over. There are amazing images of women on cattle in the Hyde Park rally. You just see people everywhere. It's almost frightening how many people there are. And then there's a cattle truck, and there's a little woman in her stays and her skirts doing this and talking. And there's men in a lot of these pictures. There's a great image of people, of Emmeline Pankhurst, talking in front of the lion. They've lifted her up onto the platform of the lions at Trafalgar Square, and she's just talking to the crowds. And there's that many people that there's police lining the base of the plinth, you know, and like bouncers at a rock concert. And you look at the audience, and it's not just women, it's also men. And I think the government had to do something at some point in terms of realising, you know, a lot of the country are listening, and it's not just women, it's men as well.
It's not going away.
It's not going away, yes, yes. But, so I think it plays its role, but I don't... And in some of the commentaries I've read, they say, not to criticise the rallies, but to say that it wasn't that affected in the end the bill that granted women the vote.
It's got to be a combination of everything, hasn't it? You know, influential philanthropists and protests, all.
Yes, yes.
And
I don't think you can put your finger on it, maybe. Yeah.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, I don't think these things should follow a formula. Oh, here's a formula, this is how it works, so let's do it like that. Things erupt and things take the form they need to take. Well, I suppose. I don't know how true that is today.
And art barely plays its part, or any part in this.
Yeah, yeah.
The other way around, from the top down, art often plays a fantastic amount, from huge statues of kings and queens, and or Stalin or something that's 50 feet high, as opposed to really impress you and frighten the living deadheads out of you, or you know, pictures of what's going to happen to you if you oppose us, for instance, or overall the public in the past, in particular, art was meant to impress you and make you realise you couldn't do anything about the situation, whatever it was.
No, I mean, I you know, I'm obviously an artist, and I really am very passionate about art. But I also, you know, think art didn't. I mean, I'm not. It's not that I'm trying to find some big role for art either. So I should say that. But for me, art is a way of really thinking about the world. So you can't help but also wonder at the fact that it sometimes in the past has just illustrated the world or illustrated things like the power dimensions, you know, statues of Stalin or, I mean, famously Courbet, of course, you know, the big statue, I forget who it's of because my history is not very good, but, you know, in the time of the Paris Commune, artists have often been very, very active, and Courbet, who I think is a great artist, but he just paints apples. He did them in a revolutionary way. In terms of art discourse, he did something very amazing. He brought art very home. But that's not going to change the world or be of interest to anyone unless you're interested in painting, you know, like me or something. But nonetheless, what Courbet did as a man is really, really interesting. And he was behind getting the column. I forget what it's called. I want to call it the Van Damme column, but that's just my visual memory. I don't know if that's the right word. And he had the whole thing, you know, knocked down and really radical. Which is why I'm in the research I'm doing, I'm very interested in what artists have done with their lives. Would they have done that if they weren't artists?
The connection between their art and their actions.
Yeah,
their
agency. Yeah, I'm very interested in that. But that's not because I want to say their actions are more special than someone who wasn't an artist and did similar things. But I'm.
What is peculiar about an artist and the actions opposed to anybody else?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I can see that. I don't know what it is. But
no, I don't, but I'm sort of interested in that. Yeah.
Chap had a question here first.
Just a quick point. We're talking about the role of art. I don't think art always, in terms of the role we talked about tonight, ought to be seen just in terms of convincing those who aren't convinced as propaganda. Mm-hmm. It also has an internal aspect in giving strength and confidence to those people who are involved in the movement.
Absolutely.
Like the hallway badge. Like the festivals, like the processions, you know. I mean, it's like that thing we talk about on the British Left, for example. We have, you know, politics with a capital P. If you look at successful mass movements, successful political movements, we've always brought in the counterculture, art as enjoyment, as strength, as optimism. The people who actually agree with and pushing them forward, giving them confidence, giving them a sense of enjoyment in their struggle.
Yes.
And that's what all the lot about you showed tonight. About that.
Yes, it's just especially about Holloway.
It's about going to the heart of people who wanted to change the world, not necessarily the people who were outside the camp. That's it.
Yeah. Really valuable point.
I'm actually interested in art as enhancing observation, and I was very interested in the comment that you made about how your observation of the photographs changed when you actually were set about drawing them. I wondered if you could expand on that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you'd think I'm a visual artist, so I'm probably good at visually recognising things. And then the first time I did that was when we were at the Women's Library, and we actually never used the image, but we were going to reproduce this great image of Caxton Hall, and it's a sort of slightly more elaborate version of a hall like this, and there's some famous suffragettes and Emmeline Pankhurst and Emmeline Pethick Lawrence up on the desk, and then a room full of ladies with big hats, you know, And then these big banners coming down. It's a terrific photo. And I spent about 3 days really carefully. And I don't enlarge or make them smaller. I'm just faithful to a reproduction. And it was about a day in, and I realised something I'd never realised, even though I was loved looking at this image, was that the women, some of the women had a little piece of cloth pinned to their jacket. Once you noticed it, it was really obvious, but because they're little tiny people, and then some of them had these scrolls, and that's when I found out that actually, no, this was the petition, and that after that meeting, they were actually going to storm the Houses of Commons, and Black Friday was going to happen. And I only noticed that a day into drawing. There's a beautiful photo of the People's Militia, Sylvia Pankhurst, when she was working with the East London Workers' Federation. She got, I've forgotten his name, he was very handsome, General Vane or something. Anyway, he worked with Baden-Powell, and he was a general, and she managed to get him to come and train the people who worked in the East End Workers' Federation with guns and stuff, so that they could protect themselves as a local militia if they needed to. And there's this photo of these, mainly women, but some men, in these sort of blouses up to here and brooches and skirts, and they're kneeling in Victoria Park, in the East End, with these rifles. So it's a really powerful image, you know, just slightly disturbing. And I was drawing that with a lot of joy. And then I realised that one of them, I'm sure, is Sylvia Pankhurst, and it's not reproduced this much, this image, but when it has been, it never says, oh, and Sylvia Pankhurst is second in at the top. And I'll swear my life on it, because I've looked at that many pictures of her, and I wouldn't have noticed. So there's something about, and I have to say, as somebody who, I loved doing that observation drawing when I was a child, because that's what you think art is. And then you sort of stop doing that at art school, for lots of really valuable reasons, actually. Art's not just about showing off how good you are at drawing, sort of thing. And now through this research, I've sort of come back to realising how powerful drawing through observation is. Whether it's a good observational drawing at the end doesn't actually matter.
Absolutely.
It's how it brings you into contact with the world.
I think that just the act of drawing really matters. Your observation doesn't actually matter whether the drawing itself, it comes out as a good observational drawing or not. It's connected you more closely with the image, and you learn so much from doing that.
Yes, you do, and I hadn't. It was really humbling to realise something like that, actually.
Yeah,
you know, with my art students, you know, with all the stuff we do now, which is all really well and good, I found myself setting them my crit group homeworks, where I just want them to sit in their kitchen for an hour every day and just look and just draw.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going to make a big song and dance about it, you know, and actually, you know, some of them have been really enjoying that. It's like, oh, am I allowed to do this? It's like, yes, you are, and actually, this actually might... This teaches you something or keeps you open to something. So, yeah, that's just something I got back from this work that was really powerful.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And this gentleman at the back here.
Hello, thank you for the talk. I enjoyed it very much. I'm a composer, and I'm a political composer. It's very easy to be a political composer if you use text, if you set text. What I don't want to put into your mouth, but did you say you were struggling about the political artists? Because it would be very interesting for me to hear something of the way that you're struggling, because I'm struggling to be a political composer without the use of text, that pure music can be a political statement. And I just want to
hear you. Well, when I would say I agree with you, I think a pure piece of music can be a political statement, but that's a really complicated...
Yeah.
Complicated thing. You see, the way I would... I mean, I'm also reading a lot of philosophy, and I find philosophy... When I studied philosophy at Masters, which at that time I didn't study because I thought it would help my art, I'd sort of given up art. I was an activist in Prague after the revolution for about 7 years. And I gave up art. This is rather idealistic, but I was young. I was in my 20s. And a lot of my drawing was around nature. And I just suddenly realised I can't keep drawing nature when actually we treat nature so badly. And so I sort of literally left the studio, which was very painful for me to do. When I was living in Czechoslovakia, I actually didn't give up art. I was still performing and doing stuff, but I mainly used my body and protested. Anyway, when I came back to England eventually, I was really confused what I was doing with my creativity, because protest was important, but I wasn't sure it did change the things I wanted to change. Because actually, links to what you were saying, I'm actually really interested in what happens to people in all this, at the molecular level of change. So you're right, art plays a very powerful role in the exchange of, say, the medal to a woman who's come out of, and it's not in the press and it's not in all the art books, but actually there's something hugely political and artistic about that gesture, and all the more so because it happens in mundane life rather than on a stage. So the reason I struggle, I'm going to go round the fences, and that's going to be frustrating for you.
No, it isn't.
Because I think the short answer to this is that there's something, if I go back to philosophy, so I ended up studying philosophy as a way to refine, and I refound myself as an artist, is that fundamentally to really open up in a very honest way as a singular substance rather than a heroic individual, as a singular substance to notions of being alive, Heidegger, I read quite a lot of Heidegger, you know, we talk about issues of being. I think in today's age is immensely political in a way that I'm only just beginning to sort of understand, but it's not political in the way that it would lead to a political change of the statutes or a discussion in the Houses of Commons. So I think fundamentally, this is going to sound very grandiose, but I think fundamentally art is a political gesture, the first political gesture. But then I would look back to the ancient Greeks, not to be nostalgic, but this whole idea of, Plato talks about the good, and he's criticised for being didactic, and there are problems with Plato, but actually when you really read his philosophical works, he's not trying to define the good, and he says we can't define the good, but that if one really opens oneself up to the otherness of the good, that is a non-human dimension, but not God, not a political leader, not just something unknowable because we can only know through human structures, then that opens up your potential to be a better citizen, he would say. And there's something in that correspondence between this sort of individual but not egotistical openness to form, because the good is a type of form in the world, that I think this sounds a bit crass, but if we had more of that in the world, and less as a cultural form that we go and see at a gallery, but that is embedded in life, then I think we'd not have the environmental problems we have today, and might not be in situations where we have to engage in political protest that doesn't do anything. But I mean, that's sounding idealistic, and I'm not trying to come up with some formula for what we should do, but I...
The governing class in Britain...
Sorry, I can't answer that properly, but I think there is an answer, and it's really... Yeah, sorry,
the governing class in Britain and in North America used to be trained in the classics. And I imagine that's what you're talking about.
How do you mean? Like...
They used to be taught about how that Greek philosophy and how Athens was governed,
yes.
The ancient Athens was governed... as a preparation for being the governors of big countries. I mean, you were taught by dons in Oxford or Cambridge about how to be a top politician.
But that's something else, isn't it? I mean, it's an interesting parallel, but that's not the Plato... That's not the way to do Plato, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, possibly not. What I'm saying is somebody else thought.
Because then it becomes a rod of power. And I think this comes back to what you were saying a little. There's something here in the relationship to power. Because all of our knowledges and our cultural forms always end up being linked to power. Whether it's power to do something, which can be something quite good, but usually it's power to do something for someone else, or power to rule and to keep the world static. Whatever reason, so that's Plato taken linked to power, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
I'm more interested in Plato being read by a singular substance who has to come to terms and work out things in relationship to that and to relationship to a community of people they might live with, where it's not about having to do something with Plato or it having to link to power. Of course, this is all inadequate thinking. It's just, but it's that's the difference. Interesting that happens is almost confirmation of what I'm trying to say, but I'm just not interested in it on that cultural legitimised level, because then Plato can't do the work that I think some of Plato's philosophy can do in a really radical way.
You don't know what was happened in those tutorial rooms. The very thing might have happened.
Okay,
I'm going to have to call it a night, unfortunately, because we have to tidy up before they kick us out. So once again, I would just like everyone to thank Esther for talking and for this very interesting session.